This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
Joy Drive on Joy 94.9 FM in Melbourne, Joy on your digital radio, iHeartRadio, TuneIn.com, or the Joy app. No matter where you are, you can always take Em and Warren with you.
It is a quarter past four.
We were just talking a few minutes ago about our phobias, and I was telling Em that I've got this terrible fear of snakes. And yeah. I know where it came from because my mother, when we were bushwalking when I was a kid, saw one and screamed her head off.
Oh. And then her fear resonated.
I think that's where it came from. Mm. That was the first time that I felt this fear of snakes. Anyway, but phobias can cause us, I guess, to worry about or dread and avoid the things or the situations that we do fear. And in some cases, they can be problematic and interfere with our daily lives. Well, the good news is they are treatable. And Bronwyn Graham is an associate professor of psychology from the University of New South Wales. Been looking into this. Bronwyn, welcome to Joy Drive.
Thank you so much for having me.
Bronwyn, let's start with the difference between a fear and a phobia. What is it?
So everybody has fears. It's perfectly normal, and it's the thing that has allowed us to evolve as humans for the many thousands of years that we've been here. A phobia is a really, really intense fear. So it's much bigger than what you would normally experience, say, if you kind of walk past a spider and maybe have a little jump. It's something that causes you to feel a lot of distress, to go to great lengths to avoid it, and it causes impairment in your daily life.
Bronwyn, how do phobias develop? You've said they're essentially, you know, bigger fears, fears that have grown into more. How do they develop?
So it's really common for people to have reported having a really early life experience with the thing that they're afraid of. So I was interested to hear what Warren was saying about his experience with his mum, because it's quite interesting that you don't actually need to have direct experience with the phobic object. You can actually watch someone else behaving fearfully in the presence of, you know, a spider or a snake or express concerns about going on an aeroplane, and that can be powerful enough to develop a phobia.
So it is potentially that incident that I remember could potentially have been the trigger of my phobia.
It can be, yeah, and that's something that we call vicarious learning, right? So where you're learning through the people around you about what's safe and what's dangerous, and that has served us a good purpose because it helps us learn about the things that we need to avoid. But obviously, if you take it to an extreme length, it can then become problematic in your life.
Can phobias be passed down through generations, like through our genes or something like that, as a protective mechanism, for example?
Yes, so there is evidence that there's a heritable component to phobias. So if a family member has a phobia, then you're more likely to also have a phobia. And we also know that we are more likely to develop phobias to certain types of objects and situations that our ancestors would have faced. So things like animals or water, storms. These are the sorts of things that it helped us to be afraid of in times past, because if we avoided them, then we could stay alive long enough to pass on our genes. But unfortunately, the cost of that is that we are now more likely to develop excessive phobias to these sorts of things.
How common are phobias? How many of us suffer from having phobia?
So 1 in 13 of us will have a phobia. Phobias are the most common anxiety disorder, and anxiety disorders are the most common mental health condition that we face collectively.
So what are the most common phobias that you see, Bronwyn?
So animal phobias are the most common subtype of phobias, but we also see things like situational phobias. So that's things like heights, small spaces, the claustrophobia that people are quite familiar with, as well as blood injection injury phobia. So that's where you might be afraid of needles, of having your blood drawn or seeing medical procedures either on yourself or other people. And that can be quite concerning because ultimately it ends up with people avoiding getting things like routine medical care.
So when you say blood injection injury, so it's not so much a fear of the sharp needle itself. It's a fear of the harm that it could do when it's used.
Well, the content of the fear, so exactly what the person fears will happen, it differs from individual to individual. And that's actually a really important part of the treatment, because if we can identify what the person fears will happen, then we can test out that belief. And so making that therapy really individualized is a key part of it being successful.
We're chatting with Bronwyn Graham, Associate Professor of Psychology from UNSW, about treating phobias with exposure therapy, which brings me to our next question. Are phobias treatable?
Absolutely. So that is the good news. Phobias are probably the most treatable of all anxiety disorders. And we do so using a technique called exposure therapy. So what exposure therapy involves is helping the person to confront the thing that they're afraid of in a really gradual way. So for someone with spider phobia, we might start off just by exposing them to a very small spider that is safely contained in a glass jar. And then we gradually work our way up to bigger spiders, different species, and getting more sort of intense interactions with the spider.
Bronwyn, I imagine it's important that this therapy is supervised, because I took it upon myself once to say, you know what, I'm going to expose myself to a snake so that I can get over this phobia. And I went to this snake demonstration, and to cut a long story short, it was really busy. I got trapped into a corner where I couldn't get out of this small space with one exit, and kids were given snakes to wrap around their necks, and one came up to me and started banging its head, the snake's head, against me. And I got so scared and I ran out, and actually made my phobia worse. So how important is it to make sure that someone does guide you through this process?
Yeah, well, first of all, congratulations on taking it upon yourself to try and expose yourself. But sorry that you had that experience, because yes, it is that the key thing about exposure therapy is that it's gradual. So I think a big misconception is that we will lock you in a room with your biggest fears and run away and just leave you to sit in there and you know, expose yourself to it. That's not at all what we do. Right. So the therapist actually models every step before the person who's receiving the treatment does it. So that's a really informative part for the person. And it's also something that can help them see that, okay, this is something that I can do. So that modeling is critical. And that's why you need someone in the room doing it with you. But then, yeah, the other thing is that we go really slowly. It's the only way to get someone to progress up and to test out what they think is going to happen in each of those situations.
Is there a way to do it in terms of the amount of time that you take with exposure? Like, is one long session better than several shorter ones, or vice versa?
Yeah, so traditionally exposure therapy has been given as several shorter sessions. So your typical scenario is that you would go to your therapist's office, say once a week or once every couple of weeks, for an hour at a time. But the other way that you can deliver exposure therapy is by doing it all in one go. So that would be a session that's about 3 hours long, and you work your way through all of the steps in the exposure therapy in that one session. And what our research has recently shown is that when you compare the two approaches, they lead to the same reduction in symptoms. So we see large reductions in fear, large reductions in avoidance for both of those approaches. But the single session is actually done in a substantially shorter amount of time, so about 50% less time.
So practically, I imagine the shorter session would be better.
Absolutely, because the other thing that we need to consider is that people have to arrange their lives to get to this treatment, right? So that's things like arranging childcare, arranging absences from work or school, paying for parking and transport. People who live in rural areas might need to travel great distances. So it's really important, because people are quite hesitant to attend exposure therapy, I think, because of the reputation or the fear that we're going to lock you in a room with your biggest fear. So we want to do everything that we can to encourage people to get treatment for these conditions because they are treatable. And so if we can offer sessions that can be done in a single long duration session, then that could be a really big incentive for people to get their phobias treated.
And I would also imagine, Bronwyn, that like if I was doing a snake session with you, you know, there's potential that I could think, okay, you know what, the tiger snake's coming out tomorrow, I'm not going back.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. So there's what we find in the single session is that people tend to get a really good momentum going. And we find people feel really proud of themselves. It's actually a really incredible therapy to watch because people make such great progress in a short amount of time. And that momentum, you just can't get that in a 1 hour session. Because by the time the person comes back in 2 weeks, and as you point out, if they come back, you sort of have to start again. And so the single longer duration session has a lot of advantages in that respect.
Bronwyn, other than, you know, a single longer format phobia treatment, what are some other changes you'd like to see to enable more phobias to be treated?
So we currently have Medicare rebates available for sessions with psychologists or clinical psychologists. And under the current structure, you can access up to 10 sessions, or it's 20 sessions until the end of this year because of COVID, in a calendar year. The problem is that the rebates are structured in such a way that the maximum rebate that you can claim is for a 50-minute session or longer. So what that means is that a person who's attending a 50-minute session will receive the same rebate as someone who receives a single 3-hour session, but they're going to be paying the psychologist by the hour. So even though we've just found that single session exposure is actually the most time effective and efficient treatment, it's going to cost people more to receive this treatment because they won't get the same amount of rebate. So if we could change the rebate structure via Medicare to say that people are eligible for up to 10 hours of treatment per year, irrespective of whether those hours are done all at once or spread out over multiple sessions, that would be such a simple change that would cost the government nothing, but would mean that people can access therapy in a much more flexible way.
And I'm sure also that there's a cost, you know, to the economy of phobias in terms of, you know, lost work, productivity, et cetera, as well.
Oh, absolutely. Anxiety disorders as a whole cost the Australian economy billions of dollars each year in terms of lost productivity, in terms of accessing treatment. So there's a real financial imperative to ensure that people have access to timely and efficient and effective treatment.
Bronwyn, great to chat with you. I'm really looking forward to starting the treatment for the snake phobia.
Good on you. I'm glad to hear that.
Bronwyn, thanks so much for joining us on Joy Drive today.
Thank you for having me.
That's Bronwyn Graham, Associate Professor of Psychology from the University of New South Wales.
Joy Drive. We ask the questions so you don't have to.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help us keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.